Hyperion to a satyr.
Welcome to the 20th episode of Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Podcast Network's Hamlet podcast. I'm your host, Siskoid, your guide on a scene-by-scene, deep-dive look at Shakespeare's masterwork through the lens of not only the text, but many film, television, comics, and music adaptations. Today we continue Act 3, Scene 1 with Shakespeare's best-known speech, To Be or Not to Be. These are the most famous words in the English language and almost the dead center of the play. And this speech is reputedly the bane of every actor who's ever had to play Hamlet, because after all, your audience is likely to know it by rote, may well have seen other actors do it, and remember those performances clearly. What do you bring to it that is your own and yet true to the character? How do you reinterpret and make fresh a speech that is so famous as to slip into cliché and devoid of context, as multiple pop culture quotations of it have been? That may be true. Within the context of the play itself, I think it continues to fascinate. First of all, what is it about? The easy answer is suicide, but why would Hamlet consider such an act now? He's just been revitalized by the arrival of the players and hopes to catch his uncle in a trap. Some stagings have chosen to restructure the play so that the speech comes in Act 2 instead, as a way to resolve or cheat this issue. The director and actor must also decide if Hamlet's words are heard by anyone else, and if Hamlet knows that he's being heard. What we might forget is that not only are Claudius and Polonius standing behind Aenerys, but Ophelia never exited the stage. The conventions of theater still allow Hamlet to pronounce his soliloquy to the audience alone, but what if the other characters hear his meditation on death and the afterlife? And if Hamlet does know he's being watched, how much of the speech can still be sincere, and how much is performance? Let's look at the text itself before diving into specific performances. To be or not to be? That is the question. Yes, that's the question indeed. There's something implied in the choice of verb here that is more profound than to live or not to live, or to die or not to die, or to commit suicide or not to commit suicide. The question is about existence itself. Critic Harold Bloom likes to say, and I like to believe it's true, that Hamlet is one of two characters that got away from Shakespeare. The other is Falstaff. So complex, deep, and alive that he delays the play's action rather than allow events to proceed towards his inevitable death. Hamlet approaches metafiction in this sense, as if instinctively aware that he's a character in someone's story. We call that someone Shakespeare, he calls her Fortune. And he refuses to let that story play out as scripted, because if he is, as he suspects, in a tragedy, it will inevitably end with his death. And even if it doesn't, the end of the story would signal the end of all its characters anyway. Stories end. It's Hamlet who forces the story to last as long as it does, problematically long. And though he does die at the end, he's ready to do so, as if aware that he did enough during the length of the story to achieve a certain literary immortality, which is indisputable in hindsight. Compared to Falstaff, who has a false death scene in his first appearance, goes on to star in a play that has nothing to do with Prince Hal, and then dies off stage rather than on it. Hamlet may dress it up in ideas of suicide, possibly for the benefit of the spies, but he's sincerely talking about oblivion. And if fated to die, would the murder of his uncle not then send him to the same hellish place suicide would? Whether this nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing, end them. To die, to sleep, no more. And by a sleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to, tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. To die, to sleep, perchance to dream, aye. There's the rub. The speech sits in the middle of the play, so should act as a turning point. And structurally, it would seem that a better turning point is the play's The Thing, or even Claudius's Give Me Light. But there's the rub. A strong contender. Before this line, Hamlet is dour and would rather die than complete his mission. After it, he rejects suicide. He rejects Ophelia, sending her into madness. And Claudius, hearing all this, confirms his order to send him to England, where he'll have him killed. Hamlet's choice is to be, and it is made at this point in the speech. And since he is, He completes his mission and fulfills the promise of the tragedy. For in that sleep of death what dreams may come, when we have shuffled off this mortal coil, must give us pause. There's the respect that makes calamity of so long life. For who would bear the whips and scorns of time, the oppressor's wrong, the proud man's contumely, the pangs of despised love, the law's delay, the insolence of office, and the spurns that patient merit of the unworthy takes, when he himself might his quietus make with a bare bodkin? Who would fardels bear to grunt and sweat under a weary life? Hamlet's vision is grim indeed. The only reason we don't kill ourselves is the fear of what lies beyond. Could the afterlife be worse than the mortal world itself? But this is Hamlet's vision of Denmark. Such is life in the unweeded garden. But that the dread of something after death, the undiscovered country from whose born no traveler returns, puzzles the will. In the play, we have Denmark, Norway, Poland, and England. But death is the fifth country, and perhaps the most important one. Hamlet Sr. went to Norway, but eventually had to go to that undiscovered country too, as will most of the characters. There's also a hint that Hamlet may be putting on a show for his observers. He says no traveler returns from there, but clearly he's met at least one, his father's ghost, who has told him a little something about the horrors of that other world. He doesn't reveal that fact here, because he doesn't want to let his secret mission slip from his lips? Or is it because he has more or less forgotten what started the ball rolling, blunting his purpose? And Hamlet will also be taking a trip that is supposed to mean his death. The undiscovered country here might be England. Let's keep going. And make us rather bear those ills we have than fly to others that we know not of. Thus conscience does make cowards of us all, and thus the native hue of resolution is sicklied o'er with the pale cast of thought, and enterprises of great pith and moment, with this regard, their currents turn awry, and lose the name of action. As the speech ends, Hamlet finally notices Ophelia. Soft you now, the fair Ophelia, nymph in thy horizons be all my sins remembered.
To be or not to be? That is the question.
Starting with Branagh's adaptation, Hamlet has been called to the Hall of Mirrors, but no one's there. He enters trepidatiously and ends up facing himself in a mirror, triggering a meditation on self-slaughter. Each of these mirrors is also a door, and at least some of those doors have a special feature that allows you to look through the mirror. It's a wonderful cinematic conceit that allows Hamlet to say the speech directly to Claudius and Polonius, giving it an additional layer of irony and meaning. Suddenly, the Sea of Troubles is right behind that door, even foreshadows his sea voyage, and Hamlet talks about taking arms against his uncle. He simultaneously would take arms against himself, as he's talking to his own reflection. In this one mise-en-scene, everything Hamlet is facing is represented, the enemies both without and within. The scene's central ambiguity remains. Does Hamlet know he's being seen? We've seen him navigate Elsinore's various secret passages and priest holes, so it's possible he knows, or at least suspects, the spies are on the other side of the mirror. We can't know if all the mirrors are two-way, or if Hamlet specifically chose one that was. The irony works whether Hamlet is aware of it or not. Taken as an address to Claudius, the words take on a different bent. In particular, the enumeration of this world's evils one must bear, or that he specifically, him, Hamlet, must bear. The oppressor's wrong is the most on the nose, but there's also law's delay, justice for his father's murder subverted, and insolence of office, of course. Hamlet must also deal with despised love, and at least one proud man. Reverse the idea and make Hamlet address himself. How much of what he says can apply to him? In the next sequence, he will admit to being proud, for example. If his talk of suicide is sincere, how much of it is motivated by an unwillingness to become the monster he knows he must become to enact his revenge? How much is to protect his loved ones from himself? Hamlet knows he's about to get a confession from Claudius through the play, within a play, knows events are about to speed towards a dreadful resolution. One answer to why he would contemplate suicide at this turning point of the play is that it's his last chance to prevent the evils that must surely befall Elsinore if he goes through with his plan. At the end of a slow advance towards the mirror, Hamlet pulls out a dagger, the bare bodkin from the speech, eliciting a startled reaction from the men watching on the other side. Claudius almost seems to grab at Polonius to make sure the man doesn't cry out or attempt to stop Hamlet. The image quotes an earlier moment in which Hamlet kisses the sword and swears revenge. The death of a father, the promised murder of a stepfather, the idea of self-annihilation. These ideas are interconnected. As Hamlet speaks the safe words, making his plans lose the name of action, he taps the mirror with the point of the dagger. The image is ambiguous, but full of possibilities. Hamlet might be killing himself symbolically, or at least his past self, finally shedding the man who would never commit murder, finally erasing the books in his mind, as promised at the end of Act 1. He points the dagger at Claudius, but really, he sees himself. So might the mirror create an osmosis between murderers, past and future? He might be attacking unreality itself, the world of thoughts, but not of deeds. Or it could be an interesting way to stage the impossibility of suicide, as the blade hits a barrier of self-preservation before it can ever reach Hamlet's self. Now, having placed this speech between the nunnery scene and the play's The Thing, far from prying eyes, Olivier gives Hamlet a reason to sincerely deliver the speech. Hamlet has just hurt Ophelia deeply and learned he can trust no one. Without the players in the mix, he hasn't had the opportunity to think of the mousetrap either. As we leave the previous sequence, in one of those vertiginous camera moves, we move away from Ophelia's reaching hand. Is she seeing the ghost, whose point of view Olivier's camera evokes? Is this the onset of her madness? And up, up, up through walls and dizzying staircases until we land on the back of Hamlet's head, looking down from the highest parapet into the crashing waves below. The camera moves further in, zooming into his head itself. We even see his brain until we are looking out through his eyes. Whatever spirit the camera represents and whose point of view we share, it can even go into a person's thoughts. It is a four-dimensional experience with shifting perspectives and superimposed images. Hamlet's forehead with the foaming sea laid on top of it, shifting back and forth between interior voiceover and exterior monologue. His sea of troubles is made manifest in the ocean itself, or indeed suggests the metaphor, and becomes a means to achieve the suicide he longs for as well. The cadence of internal-external monologue moves as the waves do. There's an ebb and flow to it.
Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing, end them. Die. To sleep no more.
Say what you will of Olivier's choices, especially regarding some important cuts and restructuring, but he has a visual flair that adds meaning to the words. He takes out the dagger, reclining on the castle spire, closes his eyes, and almost falls asleep. The camera slowly creeps towards him until a musical sting brings him out of his reverie, pushing the camera back to a more objective POV as he cries.
Sleep. A chance to dream.
Hamlet's lassitude makes him accidentally drop his dagger into the sea, an image of the very inaction the soliloquy exposes. Not only could that dagger be used to commit suicide, but also to commit murder. Hamlet loses his resolve for either, and again, Olivier visually enhances the idea. He does so again at the end of the speech, when Hamlet talks about enterprises of great pith and moment. He stands on the platform, facing outward to his country, its past, his father's deeds. When they turn awry in the speech, he turns back inward to Elsinore, his problems, and his lonely fate. The irony of these lines is revealed. Hamlet's greatness, and Denmark's, is turned awry by his fatal flaw, that of inaction. He leaves with a now complete loss of motivation, his passions waiting to be reignited by the arrival of the players. On to the BBC version. From the anguish on Hamlet's face, Jacoby does not allow him to suspect he's being watched. He speaks directly to camera, as Ophelia is sometimes visible walking in the background, unseen and oblivious. Once again, I'm entranced by Derek Jacoby's performance. He always manages to surprise me. His line readings convey perfectly the inner turbulence of the character, shifting tone as the character actually thinks about what he's saying rather than recites it. For example, here's an emotional reading of the opening lines of the speech.
To be.
Bitterness verging on anger.
Or not to be.
Softer, a revelation to his audience.
That is the question.
And later.
To die.
Anger.
To sleep. No more.
Sudden realization that pacifies him.
It is a consummation devoutly to be wished.
Joy.
To die. To sleep. To sleep.
Another realization, this one inspiring dread.
The chance to dream.
And so on, keeping the speech fresh every turn. This is not something Hamlet has rehearsed in his mind. It is the true outpouring of thought as it occurs. The list of hardships is just that, a list, until he gets to pangs of despised love, when the items suddenly become personal and Jacoby lets us know what is rhetoric and what Hamlet truly cares about.
The oppressor's wrong, the proud man's contumely. The pangs of despised love. The law's delay, the insolence of office, and the spurns the patient merit of the unworthy takes, when he himself might his quietus make with a bare bodkin.
When he takes his dagger out, it's to insouciantly mime a suicide. He doesn't really consider it except as a daydream. Behind him, painted boards showing a hellish plain. The undiscovered country as background to this scene, what else can the decor be? Because surely it has nothing to do with Denmark's topography. It adds to the reflective and dreamlike quality given to the end of the speech. As Hamlet speaks of travelers not returning, he fingers his father's medallion. Does he wonder, as we do, at the ghost's true identity? At the supposed finality of death, the line puzzles the will almost takes on another meaning here. By this subtle action, Jacoby manages to connect this speech with the previous one, Oh, what a rogue and peasant slave am I. The show has often questioned why and how Hamlet suffers a setback in Act 3 after having come up with a plan to reveal the king's guilt in Act 2, but there's a double proof to be sought in Act 3. Hamlet must prove Claudius a murderer, lest he prove the ghost, another king, a false harbinger. This adaptation of the play reconciles the apparent incongruity by more overtly turning thoughts of the ghost's honesty to those of mortality. One thought evolves into another. They're well linked. Zeffirelli, in his film, places the speech between the nunnery scene and his meeting with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, which evolves into the player's arrival. He has just violently rejected Ophelia and has yet to have his spirits lifted by the newcomers. Mel Gibson plays it as Hamlet at his lowest. He enters his ancestor's crypt, and surrounded by tombs and skeletons, he delivers the speech. There's no question that he's alone and unheard. This is his depression talking, as he faces death itself. At first, I felt the intent of the speech was muddled by this staging. Shots of dead royals in their tombs, as Hamlet talks about suicide, seem jarring. Surely, those kings and queens didn't all take their own lives, and Hamlet praying to two different tombs surely takes away from what would otherwise be a visit to his father's. But time and again, Zeffirelli has created meaning from imagery, replacing or supplementing the text. Looking at it with a more open mind, then, a new interpretation emanates from the scene. Zeffirelli's Hamlet isn't just facing suicide, but mortality itself. And opening this speech up to other ways of dying reminds us of a simple fact. There are more ways to commit suicide than the sudden stab of a dagger or a fall from a great height. By simply choosing to go against his uncle, Hamlet spells his own doom. It's not that he would commit suicide rather than commit regicide. It's that regicide is its own suicide. Not many men come out of such a mission unscathed or even alive. We know this is a tragedy, so we know that by choosing to act, Hamlet, in effect, commits suicide. He goes to his own death willingly. Or does the water come to him? We really have to compare this speech to the gravediggers later in the play. So though Zeffirelli changes the structure of the play to render moot the problem of Hamlet's backpedaling in Act 3 after the play's the thing, his staging here still evokes a justification for it. As written, Hamlet may well feign a speech about suicide to confuse the spies, but at the same time may sincerely discuss doubts about going through with his planned action. For such action will likely result in his death, and such an outcome naturally creates doubt, the nature of which he mentions.
And enterprises of great pitch and moment. With this regard,
their currents turn awry and lose the name of action.
Hamlet's anger rises through the speech, nothing new for Gibson's visceral performance, but ends in rhetorical defeat as the prince admits that great enterprises turn awry when they are overthought, as they are here. His voice cracks, his shoulders stoop, and he goes back up to the world. In the next scenes, as previously discussed in earlier episodes, since they're out of order, he'll find his second wind. Hamlet 2000 has a unique placement for the speech, just after the spies make their plans and before Hamlet meets up with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. It's a scene completely divorced from the other characters. No one sees or hears Hamlet, who goes in and out of voiceover anyway. The staging is, I must admit, a little precious for my tastes. The scene takes place in a blockbuster, specifically its action section, to go with Lose the Name of Action. This Hamlet is a film buff and amateur filmmaker, which makes the setting fairly natural for him. The screens behind him show fiery explosions of the same kind seen during Hamlet's meeting with the ghost, where they evoked the hell the latter had escaped from. Here, it is the undiscovered country that Hamlet fears. Though set chronologically before Hamlet's meditation on the player in the film, we at Hyperion to a Satyr can remember that scene's use of James Dean as the example actor. When we discover at the end of the To Be or Not to Be speech that the explosive film behind Hamlet is The Crow, City of Angels, a link is made between James Dean and the star who brought The Crow to life, Brandon Lee. Hamlet seems to be fascinated by actors who died tragically young, his own death prefigured in those of his idols. Now, of course, City of Angels, the second film, doesn't and couldn't star Brandon Lee, but if you look at the plot of that film, The Crow here comes back from the dead to avenge the loss of his son. Fathers and sons, bloody vengeance, there may be something to this. As for the performance, Ethan Hawke makes his walk as nonchalant as possible, whispering the words when they aren't coming from voiceover, running through lines at a quick, pause-free pace.
For in that sleep of death, what dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil must give us pause.
This is a jaded Hamlet, one who is either verbalizing things he's already thought about or repeating words he's written for one of his short films. It takes away from the power of the speech, but is legitimate in the context of this particular adaptation. Fodor's Hamlet places a speech very early in the story, as Hamlet sits at his reel-to-reel and speaks into a microphone just after a musical montage representing his first encounter with Ophelia, which is normally unseen but just described in the play. It is then followed by Polonia's scene with her spy Rinaldo, or in this case Rinalda. In effect, the speech is now part of Hamlet's initial set of reactions to meeting his father's ghost. At that point in his emotional journey, Hamlet is actively thinking about revenge, cutting off ties to loved ones, setting up his cover as a madman, and in this repurposed sequence, leaving a record of his thoughts to posterity. It's a suicide note on tape, except he doesn't go through with it. Hamlet's pace suggests he's been composing it in his head. He rattles off the speech rather quickly, especially the list of ills we must bear here on earth.
For who would bear the whips and scorns of time, the oppressor's wrong, the proud man's contumely, the pangs of despised love, the insolence of office, the law's delay?
The speech intercuts between a medium shot of Hamlet speaking into the microphone and a close-up of Hamlet's half-face. Was that an image of ambivalence, perhaps? The camera in that shot gets ever closer to him as we delve deeper into his consciousness. These shots are further intercut with Hamlet Sr.'s funeral as various characters kiss his dead mouth goodbye. We see Polonia in particular intimating a relationship between her and the former king and a possible role in his betrayal. At To Die, To Sleep, Perchance to Dream, those flashbacks begin with a frame of various characters all fated to die, lined up in a row. At the very end, as Hamlet himself kisses his father's cadaver, we hear the sounds of bells and seabirds, disturbing elements taking us further into the memory. The lighting in those flashbacks is blown out even more than the present day's film treatment, adding a greenish tinge to the proceedings that evokes both a sickliness and perhaps the pale cast of thought itself. A notable cut here, the speech is largely intact, but omits, for in that sleep of death what dreams may come. Why? I'm unable to come up with an answer. Perhaps Fodor felt it was too pretty a line for his horror story, or perhaps the actor skipped over it. I'm willing to hear theories. One thing the restructured Hamlets make clear is that putting to be or not to be before the players arrive, rather than after, works better if Hamlet is not spied upon, or at least doesn't know he's being spied upon. A Hamlet in that structure has yet to see a glimmer of hope and may thus be more sincere in his meditation on self-oblivion. And so it is with the Tenet version. And though spies lie in wait, the moment is so intimate, and actually outside the room, we may infer that the spies do not hear him. The speech is played around the corner of a wall in near darkness, with Hamlet progressively revealed. The way he's initially framed and backlit makes him skeletal, something supported by his t-shirt print, an image of mortality and vulnerability and of revealing something to the audience that is under the surface. Tennant has a fresh approach to almost every line in the speech. He uses long pregnant pauses to make us feel like he's thinking those words up for the first time. One of Tennant's best qualities in the role is that he doesn't seem to know what he'll say next, even though he's speaking some of the best known words in all of English literature. The best example of this freshness is that though to be or not to be is the question, he asks another, putting a question mark on the end of by opposing endem.
Well, it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing endem.
Hamlet is filled with anguish, which slowly builds towards bitterness. His eyes are closed in pain until he finally looks at us on There's the Rub. At Must Give Us Pause, he swallows hard. Just as his gorge rises at it in the graveyard scene later, Hamlet is here physically repulsed by what lies waiting in the afterlife, and by extension, by his own father's ghost. Bringing a measure of fear to this speech makes perfect sense in the context of having met an undead parent earlier. The physical signs of that repulsion continue through to Cyclede Orr, manifesting what is, in the text, merely a mental image. It continues the image of sickliness that is background to most of the play, one that covers the whole of Denmark, and is caused by the depraved behavior of its king and possibly the madness of its prince as well. Soft You Now comes hard and fast on the heels of Lose the Name of Action, springing to action, even as one gives up hope that any action can occur.
Lose the name of action, Soft You Now. The fair Ophelia.
Ophelia's appearance thus surprises Hamlet and his audience, taking us out of the meditation and back to more earthly matters. I'm surprised the speech isn't part of the montage in A Midwinter's Dream, but To Be or Not to Be is a pivotal moment in Slings and Arrows. Season 1, Episode 5, the rehearsal in this case, not the performance. Movie star Jack Crew is taken aside by director Jeffrey Tennant and asked to finally do a scene with the text. Up to that point, Jack has been paraphrasing, frustrating his castmates, and preventing the director from seeing the play. Jack's problem is every actor's. How do you make these words, the speech especially, sound fresh? How do you escape from the shadow of all the great actors who have gone before? On a metatextual level, the speech is to be Hamlet or not to be Hamlet. To make something of oneself or to fail. In the text, though Hamlet is nominally talking about actual lethal suicide, on another level, he's talking about professional suicide. Hamlet is a role filled with risk. It is fearsome. The fear of dying on stage may keep you from ever attempting the role. But if it does, you deny yourself the possibility of an enterprise of great pith and moment. That's what's at stake for the actor, as much as it is for Hamlet, who is himself an improvised actor and playwright. Jeffrey also asks him to make an important choice. Does Hamlet know he's being overheard or not? Jack doesn't have to reveal his choice so long as he makes it. Ambiguity lingers. Jack sits his back to the spies, but also smirks at the end of it. That smirk may be directed at the appearance of Ophelia to stage right, though. So did Hamlet just perform for Claudius and Polonius and thus smiles to himself, a job well done? Or is he darkly amused at remembering his sins, quote-unquote, thanks to Ophelia's appearance? Or, while unaware of the spy's presence, does he nevertheless see through the transparent ploy of his ex-girlfriend being loosed upon him? In any case, while Jack's delivery is solid, if without much nuance, his body language makes good use of the actor's own discomfort and shame. Jack is visibly contemptuous of his ability to portray Hamlet, and that makes his Hamlet contemptuous of his own ability to trap Claudius and avenge his father. As Jack utters the speech, Jeffrey starts to see the play take shape. We get the usual music cue the show uses to render the theater as a magical place. And he and the ghostly Oliver walk through the fantasy. Jeffrey's image of the scene has the spies behind a red curtain, symbolically steeped in blood, and Hamlet surrounded by candles, his spiritual illumination, or perhaps an image of mortal life's brevity and snuffability. As the sequence ends, we return to reality and Hamlet stands up to face his Ophelia, a look of marked disappointment in himself on his face. The regret is palpable. During the play in episode 6, we briefly alight on this sequence again. Budget cuts have made the fantasy version of the play impossible, but the show must go on. Jack's new Hamlet costume is a simple hoodie from his own wardrobe. The jewelry, including the appropriate skull ring, is also his, part of the osmosis between role and actor that is part and parcel of Slings and Arrows. And you could say part and parcel of Hamlet itself. As for the comics, Classics Illustrated stages the speech on a single splash page with all the important elements in frame, evoking medieval engravings. Hamlet is center stage, coming up behind Ophelia holding her book, and in the background, the two spies drawing back a curtain. The entire speech fills a single speech bubble, a steady stream of consciousness that lacks any kind of nuance, through pauses, for example. Four words are identified as difficult, and given footnote translations, oddly, conscience is one of these, given as self-examination. Seem pretty straightforward to me, but the narrator is also quite obvious, telling us upfront that the speech is about contemplating suicide. You know, lest we miss the point. The target audience might have, but it's still an awkward cliff note. This is nevertheless one of the better pages in the comic, with composition stronger than most. Hamlet creeping up behind Ophelia is more sinister and menacing than the eventual outcome of their meeting in the comic, and there's something intriguing about having all the characters in the line of sight, as if Ophelia was bait on a hook and the spies as fishermen about to reel in the prince. But these seem more accidental than planned. They at least suggest some interesting staging ideas for the play. Tom Mandrake's later adaptation also stages the speech on a single page, but paces it through the use of multiple speech bubbles. The pauses created are pretty standard, but Mandrake seems to have thought about them. For example, there's an early pause after Outrageous Fortune, indicating that perhaps taking arms is an option he had not directly considered before. He's been suffering all this time and had not truly considered taking action until this point. Though the speech often seems like Hamlet is regressing after the promise of the mousetrap, it can also be seen as a driving force for the second half of the play. Hamlet convinces himself that not acting is the wrong way to go. Unlike the original Classics Illustrated, Hamlet is shown walking alone. He's not being overheard, nor is Ophelia in sight. She turns up out of nowhere on the next page, surprising both the reader and Hamlet. The single panel here is placed inside the greater layout of the page, which shows sea-tossed Elsinore. The decaying building, with the sea of troubles at its gates, is an image of Hamlet himself. He contemplates his own mortality, even as Denmark, something much more permanent, is described as rotting around him. If a castle or country is mortal, what chance does a man have? At the center of Johnny Hallyday's French Hamlet musical, at the beginning of Disc 2, in fact, is a dirge, constructed as a showstopper based on the play's most famous speech. It uses the opening line quite a lot, and also as a title, with no translation. Though être ou ne pas être is still a famous French phrase, Hallyday opts for the original English text because, well, it's famous no matter what language you speak.
To be or not to be. 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 Encore choisir, choisir encore.
The odd thing about the arrangement is that it has backup singers. In the rock opera, these usually represent the people, courtly whispers, or Danish opinion. Hamlet's voice is Halliday's, and in this most private of moments, spied on or not, he's somehow accompanied by others. I'd like to say that it's a line reverberating across history. Its sentiment is universal. It's part of the list that Hamlet gives. But I rather think it's a mistake, thematically, and that Halliday's wish to make this a bigger production number made him forget the conventions of his own opera. The question gets asked a lot in this version of the speech, acting as a driving beat. It is asked in other ways as well. For example, the question is initially tragic and mortal. Some wordplay here, since mortel means both mortal and lethal. Hamlet moves between life and death, between flesh and dust. The choice predominates. The first line gives a false choice, again to choose again, while also makes it a repeated choice. Hamlet has been straddling the line between choosing life and suicide since before the start of the play, choosing one and then the other on a loop without resolution. Halliday correctly understands the speech as the last time he will consider death as an alternative to action. So he makes the choice again, but for the last time. Are we also to understand he believes the question to be a false choice? To be a false choice? Because ultimately it is. Hamlet may claim to long for death, but he argues strongly against it. Given who he is and the fact that he's not yet taken his own life, this contemplation can have only one outcome, and yet he hasn't acted. The alternative to dying has not been living, but rather doing nothing. His thoughts, here described as vampires, have sucked the action out of him. So while Hamlet was never going to kill himself, he needs to strike the option off his list with words so that he can move on to the active option of revenge. Lost in translation is a nice pun in the line entre bleu ciel et vert de terre, literally between blue sky and earthworm. Bleu ciel is not actually blue sky, but rather sky blue, the color. Vert de terre, yeah, earthworm, that's a link to the one going through the guts of Hamlet's metaphorical beggar. It's also a homophone of vert de terre, which could mean earth green. In French, the choice is between two colors, one representing life and the other death, though in the funereal world of the speech, these could be two visions of the afterlife, heaven and the underworld. In 1988, Derek Jacobi was asked to direct Kenneth Branagh's first stage Hamlet. It was his only directing job ever, not because he did a poor job, but because he much prefers acting. But the documentary special, Discovering Hamlet, chronicled the effort, if not the finished play. To Be or Not to Be is the only sequence from the documentary I wanted to examine on Hyperion to a Satyr, as it's incredibly intriguing as a take on the scene. He sadly doesn't go into detail, but Jacobi claims his approach is wholly rooted in the text. What is that approach? Having Hamlet speak the lines, not as a true soliloquy, but to Ophelia. In my estimation, he's entirely correct in thinking this. For one thing, Ophelia is on stage when Hamlet enters, and no stage directions have her leave or hide. Shakespeare's didascalia are always sparse, but entrances and exits are always clearly marked. What if the bard meant for Ophelia to be present and aware of the speech? The main argument against the staging is the final line, "Soff you now, the fair Ophelia," written as an interruptive and usually read as Hamlet's realization that she's present. However, it is possible to read them instead as Hamlet shushing her, giving her permission not to respond to his meditation on mortality. He's not telling himself or the audience to be quiet, but her. "Nymph, in thy horizons be all my sins remembered," now becomes the actual conclusion to be or not to be. Hamlet is perhaps admitting that what spurred this black speech on was the guilt of having cut Ophelia off from his affections. Brought into the scene so immediately like this, Ophelia is both witness and confidant. She may well be the only person Hamlet could say this to. Horatio has been absent a while, showing vulnerability for the first time since he went, quote-unquote, mad. So how much greater is Ophelia's betrayal when the spies are discovered? She hasn't just lured Hamlet into the open, but made him show his true self. In other words, Jacobi's staging seems to confirm that the speech is not an act on Hamlet's part, and furthermore, indicates that he perhaps would not have made it at all, if not for the safety provided by Ophelia. Her presence makes him admit something he should not have. Theatrical conventions aside, it also confirms that the spies heard the speech, which normally would have been along a side to the audience, representative of inner thought. On stage, there's an ambiguity that can help the audience understand that the character isn't literally talking to himself out loud, an ambiguity that is dispelled by this particular staging. And of course, it heightens the irony of Ophelia later taking her own life, acting in a way Hamlet was unable to. While her prince seems to be confiding in her, we'll find that he was planting an idea in her head instead. In this version, there's no speech without Ophelia, and in any version where she's present, hidden or not, it could be said Ophelia doesn't die but for this speech. While you're chewing on that, let's call an end to our look at Act 3, Scene 1, Part 2. Next week, Scene 1 continues and ends with the nunnery scene. In the meantime, if you have thoughts on this particular episode, please head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com, leave them there. If you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/FW podcasts. Thanks for listening, and I hope you, dear listener, will return for our look at Act 3, Scene 1, Part 3, the nunnery scene.
The rest is silence.